Anyway, I'm still John, still compulsive eater. Hope everybody had a good lunch. I think I'm going to take some of these questions and we'll keep the Ask a Basket going around again. Again, sometimes some of these I think I answered from the first thing that I held off on. I think I've answered already, and I have one here I'm going to answer a little later. I got one here. How do you know when you have a sober food plan? Well, I'd say if you're sticking to it and it seems to be working and you're not finding yourself getting off of it or having trouble sticking to it, and it's also either moving you toward or at a healthy body weight. I mean, again, I had a food plan for a while that I had no trouble sticking to, but it included damn near everything, which is not that hard to do, but it should be something. And again, I use that thing that I love that Adam says about, you know, if there's a food you you know, you want to have again while you're eating it, chances are it might be one you want to stay away from. And something else at the break about that, you know, just, you know, trying to you know, to realize that it's not easy to do this yourself, that you need a little outside help. And when in doubt in the beginning, maybe I was saying to somebody, and I've done this with people, is, you know, if you're really sort of slipping and sliding, why not get it really crisp and clean and think of the yellow light foods you have, and maybe for a while just eat green light foods. And then after you've got a certain amount of time and the obsession's broken and you're back on track, start adding them back like one by one, because maybe you don't know which one might be a problem, so maybe adding them one by one and see if you can stick to it. You know, I was saying to somebody at the break about, I've had foods where I said, well, I don't know if I have a problem with it, I'll try it and see, and I ate it after, you know, I'd say, oh, I tried it and okay, everything was fine, and then I ate it a month later, and then 3 weeks later, and then 2 weeks later, and you know what I mean? And it comes back to, oh, well, maybe I do have a problem with that one, so that's part of it. Actually, I'm going to hold on to that one too, because that will come later. How do I develop the consistency to journal daily with a demanding schedule? Well, I mean, it's up to you. I don't journal daily myself. I do try and take some time, and I'll talk about it later in the 10th step, about trying to look back constructively at the day and see if I can figure out, you know, how things went. But, you know, it's hard. You know, I guess it's a matter of trying to set out a little bit of time. And, you know, for me, like, it's like with my exercise, I have to have a time, or else the next thing you know, oh, it's 11 o'clock and I'm tired and I'm going to go to bed, that you try and set a certain time. And just, you know, I mean, I have a computer and I pop up all, I joke, I said, I might as well have, you know, pop up things like breathe, because I've gotten to the point where I need all constant reminders on things, because, and just have a little thing that pops up that, you know. If there's not a lot of recovery in a meeting, would you suggest no longer attending the meeting? Well, you know, sort of. I mean, I hate to say go away from a meeting, but if you're not getting anything out of it, that doesn't make much sense. And or to bring to the meeting, maybe, you know, as a group conscience, you know, we don't seem to be getting a lot out of this meeting. I'm in the middle of a meeting, so I'll talk about it. I know a lot of the meetings I've seen that were really strong will have a little thing in the beginning saying, please remember we're here to talk about compulsive eating and recovery, and you know, something to the extent of, this isn't group therapy, remember we're here to do that, and stick to the topic if there's one, or if it's a big book thing, stick to that. Because again, a lot of times, and it had to do with this, I see the people who come in and just want to, you know, talk about their day, or if there's a topic, let's say the topic's gratitude, they go, yeah, gratitude, that's great, so anyway, here's what happened to me today. You know, and you know, I did that for quite a while. I joke about how I was in two different OAs. The first one I was in was the one before I really got abstinent, and then I was in the second one. Now, of course, we were actually the same OA, but it was how I looked at it. OA the first time was about going to meetings, getting to talk about myself. You know, if there was a speaker, I'm thinking about, well, I wonder what I'm going to be able to say about that, and not doing much on the steps, not doing much on the big book, and I got the results I should expect from that kind of way. Whereas this time around, it's really about working steps. It's about, you know, the big book. It's about listening to speakers. I don't speak very much. You know, I'll share once in a while at meetings. And I watch the people I have a lot of respect for. They, you know, I heard a person say once, you don't learn much from speaking. You know, you learn more from listening. And so, you know, a big favor of that. And the other thing about the kind of people who do that is that, you know, there's a couple people I can think of in my area, or heard, you know, it's always these self-involved pitches, and the thing is, they haven't changed. In 5 years, they're saying the same pitch they were saying 5 years ago, and it comes down to that program thing of nothing changes if nothing changes. It may feel good to get up and, you know, talk about your all the stuff going on in your life, but, you know, so did eating an ice cream sundae. You know, it didn't really help. And so, yeah, if you're finding it's just not good, try and find it. I happen to like big meetings. I go to, you know, I go to one of the three or four meetings I go to. You know, I go to Kitchen Sink, I go to Serenity Sunday, I go to Light a Candle, I go to this other meeting in the Valley. This is 7:30 in the morning on a Sunday. God help me, I don't know how I do it. But they're big meetings, and there's a lot of strength in that, as opposed to going to, you know, where there's only a few. Now, if you that's all you have, that's all you have. But, you know, and again, be ready. I have a sponsee in Scottsdale, Arizona, who he's had to, you know, there's all kinds of mishigas going on with this local group he's in. And he's, I just said, go to other meetings. It's not like you're in the middle of nowhere. Go to other meetings. It's about your serenity. It's about your recovery. If it's all about crazy personality stuff, get away from it. You know, you got to remember why you're here. So have you struggled with what is and what isn't a substance to abstain from? Well, yeah, again, like I was saying before, you know, that's where you've got to be willing to be honest. And again, realize you have a disease that's going to be whispering in your head, no, don't lose that one, I want that one. And to be able to go to somebody who's objective and talk it out. And again, maybe give it up and then say, gee, you know, do you think you're, you know, once it's out of your system, say, well, you know what, I always did have a problem with that. You know, and again, this is about making it as easy as possible for you. So if giving up one of my foods that has always been causing me problems will make it easier in general, why wouldn't you want to do that? There's so many foods in the world. I was saying to somebody at the break, you know, is that ice cream sundae, you know, going to be any different than the last 5,000 I've eaten? You know, no, it's, you know, it's not going to taste any different, you know. One of the most annoying things about having long-term abstinence and sobriety is they come out with so many new drinks and foods. And there's a part of you that goes, I've never had a Long Island iced tea. I've never had a dark chocolate Reese's. I haven't, you know. But you know what? It's, it, you know, I can live with that. I have a sponsee who's not losing weight and weighs over 250 pounds. Any suggestions for a person? Any person who's working the steps? Well, I mean, again, it's almost like you got to go back, you know, the beginning sometimes. You know, I've heard this said, you know, if you're having trouble with any step, go back to the one before it. And if you're still having problems, go back to the one before that. And if it comes down to the first step, it's about why, you know, is this what you want your goal weight to be? Did you really come in to be 250 pounds? I don't know about you. I didn't. I wanted to be, you know, a reasonably healthy body weight. And say, well, you know what, it... You know, that you're obviously your diet isn't congruent with your desires, and you know, and say, you know, and just to be honest as a sponsee, do you want to be 250? Because this is what your situation is. The abstinence fairy is not going to hit you on the head somewhere down the way. And I think maybe that's maybe, well, if I keep working the steps, then all of a sudden, that, like I said, I find that for the most part, the road may get narrower if you've started with a reasonably strong thing, but if you're starting way out here, I don't think the road does get narrower, you know. Just another thing. This one is a little hard to understand. Is it possible to find a sponsor in AA if you're in OA? In other words, if you're talking about crossing over, I mean, I guess it's, you know, there's nothing to stop anybody just as long as you're honest about it, not like faking AA and say, geez, I'm having problems. I do know people in areas, and I know in the beginning of OA in Connecticut, you know, back down there in Los Angeles, I remember Roseanne talking about a lot of the people who were sponsors were AA sponsors because they just didn't have that many people. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's the same steps. But you got to make sure your food is in line. And otherwise, maybe, you know, I was talking to somebody during the break about they have a really good step sponsor, but they're having a problem with the food. Or not necessarily having a problem, but they're trying to get the food better defined. You know, there are people around here who will just work with you on food, you know. In other words, it is possible to have step sponsor as somebody else you're just working on with the food to get the food in line. So maybe having somebody get the food in line here, but somebody who worked the steps in AA, you know, if they're willing to do it and you're being honest that you're not in AA, then there's no reason you can't. What did you do to get out of neutral and start dismantling the engine? Was there a key? Well, for me, it was really getting serious about getting into the big book. I joke about that first time in OA, I was hanging out with all these people who were hip, slick, and cool, and we, you know, our idea was to go to meetings, go out for fellowship afterwards, get on the phone, gossip to each other about everybody, make fun of these old farts who are reading the big book, and God, if I have to hear Jack Z talk about the damn big book one more time, I'm going to shoot myself. And when I went to that other program and then I came back 7 years later, guess what? All those hip, slick, and cool people were gone. You know who was left? Jack Z. Other people who were reading the big book and duh, you know. But by then I had actually already started getting into it and I realized, God, you know, you can be around a long time and quote big chunks of the big book, but it doesn't sink in, you know. I joke, I said, every, you know, they are somehow putting new pages in this book every year, you know, because I'll go, what the hell is that? I read this thing 1,000 times. I never read that sentence before. And I, and this is actually one of my newer big books now. I used to be able to read the little big book, and then I had to go to the regular one, and now I'm up to this one. I always joke, I said, you know, when I came to OA, I didn't need reading glasses, and I didn't have gray hair, so, you know, I don't know if it's OA or not. But this is mine. I have Don't Panic on the front, which is... anybody who knows The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that's what's on the front, and that's, I joke, that's my Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But it's about getting in and working the steps so that you work on all this inner stuff that will get better. Now, again, for me, I also got some outside help. I'm a big believer, you know, that I have a sponsor who can help me with a certain amount of stuff, but the person who's a trained professional a lot of times can help with other stuff. I'm going to talk about it in a second about the fourth step, where they can help uncover stuff that goes deeper that can help you, you know, help dismantle that engine. What is the difference between a diet and restriction? And then it says something like exercise, work, medication. If I don't understand this, whoever wrote it, come tell me about it later. Well, I mean, you know, in some ways, I mean, diet gets to be known as a bad word in programming. We tend to use plan of eating, because for me, my diets always had a time clock on them, you know, and they were going to end. And, you know, and this is where that insanity comes in. I'm a really smart person, yet I go to eat this food, it's a certain level of food, and then I lose the weight, and then I go back to eating what I was eating before, and I'm shocked that I'm gaining weight, you know? Instead of saying, you know, and for me, I'm a big believer in if I want to weigh, you know, like I'm 180 now, if I want to weigh 180, I got to eat what a person who weighs 180 eats, you know? And that's a bit of a trial and error, because people go up and they go down, but, you know, to have some general idea, and if... You know, like the person was saying about their sponsee who's 250, they're obviously eating the amount of food a 250-pound person wants. And then it's, again, what do you want to eat? What do you want to weigh? You know, and say to yourself, maybe I have a disease that's maybe warping my perception and I need an outside person. Again, a higher power. And, you know, again, higher powers is what I believe in. I believe is a big higher power, but I believe there's levels under that, you know, and God speaks through people and I need help with that. So... I don't know if that's of any help. So going back, you know, when I was talking about, you know, the idea of coming in the program and just wanting to talk about yourself and not talking about experience, strength, and hope in the program, the thing about it is we all do that to a certain extent, and it's fine, especially in the beginning. This is, I call it like an arc of recovery. When you come in, there's nothing greater than to sit down at a meeting and hear people talking about stuff you thought you were the only person doing, okay? I came in, I thought I was the only person who ever took a thing of white bread, rolled it up into a ball, and ate it. And every time I tell that in a group of people, I hear a bunch of people laughing. I can go to a real world, they're like, God, that's weird. But it's wonderful because you get the identification. I am not alone. There are people like me. And that's fine for a while. And to hear that and a little give and take and talking about, yeah, I do this crazy thing with food and I do that. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But at some point, you know, that kind of recovery has to make the turn into the steps and the big book. And that's what I didn't do. I just sort of kept on that. Gee, this is a lot of fun talking about what I do with food and then about my problems. And oh my God, don't you feel sorry for me for all my problems? And you know, I don't do that anymore, you know. The other thing I tell sponsees is take everything you hear at meetings with a grain of salt. Realize that we are the most democratic organization on the face of the earth. Everybody gets 3 minutes, okay? I don't care who, you know, even in AA, if they sense you've been drinking, they're going to tell you, hey, you know, sit down and listen for a while, you know. What I heard when I first came in is take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. That was what they say. And but you know, people get up and they can be in the middle of a bad relapse, and this happened to me during my relapse. I would hear somebody say, "Oh, I agree with that. You know, that's it. Yeah, see, because I heard it at a meeting. It must be true." Well, no, I just have two people that are crazy, bouncing the same ideas and validating each other. So I always tell sponsees, you know, come and ask me. Come and you know, if you're not sure about something, you know, come and ask. You know, and you know, again, I'm a believer. I remember. This a very well-known guy down in my neck of the area, neck of the woods, Terrell. You know, he spoke at the kitchen sink meeting, and I happened to not be there that day, but I had two different sponsees who were there. And Terrell, during his talk at the one point, had not eaten bread for a while and then started eating bread again. Well, both sponsees called me, said they'd been at the meeting, and they said, you know, Terrell says he can eat bread now, and you know, and da-da-da. And I go, wait a minute. Now, Terrell, I know kitchen sink. You speak for about 35 minutes. And then you get about 15 minutes of questions. And that's the only thing you guys both of my sponsees pulled out of that talk. And the one spot, you know, once, and I said, okay, well, did you listen to what Terrell said right before that, where he said, after 19 years, comma, I decided I could try and eat bread again. How much time you got? 3 months. Okay, so, when you get to 19 years.
Look up.
Oh, yeah, there you go, Coors Light. It's a waste of time. Coors Light's like beer-flavored Perrier. never got beer. It's like a you know waste of kidneys. But, you know, and the other sponsor, he said, well, you think I'll be able to eat bread again? I said, well, the fact that, you know, you're asking me now at this amount of time, probably not, you know?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and you know, the other thing he says, it gets people ticked off sometimes is, you know, until you got 10 years, you're a newcomer, you know, which people don't like. But I'll tell you, you know, when they talk about sticking with the winners and realize, you know, people say sometimes, you know, there's as many ways to work the program as there are people in program, which is true from about 0 to about 7 years, I think. But if you watch the people from 7, 8, 10 plus, they're doing mostly the same thing, and I'm lockstep. But their program is very much the same. And you got to ask yourself, well, how come they're there and those other people do all these other things? Well, it's Darwinian evolution. Those people are doing some of those wacky things. They're not here after 7 years. I want to be with the people who are here 7, 10, 20 years. And so, you know, I believe in that concept of sticking with the winners, you know, meaning, you know, find out what they do and do it. You know, if I want what they have, I got to be willing to do what they do, you know. Other things, I'm really glad in one way I came into a program which taught me some really good habits. Come early, stay late, do service. And I got told, sit in the front. And I remember saying, why do I sit in the front? Because you're newly sober and everything is going to distract you. So sit in the front so nothing will distract you. And the other thing this I think so important in meetings is principles before personalities, you know. When I had that first slip, I was going to these meetings that were in a clubhouse, and I tended to go to all the same meetings and saw all the same people, and slowly I knew too much about every one of them, you know, and what happened is I started crossing them off, you know. Oh yeah, you say that, but I know you're sleeping with that guy's wife, or you know, yeah, but I heard you say that crazy thing that one, and slowly there was less and less people I could listen to, you know, and today I don't want that. I always love the phrase, don't shoot the people in your own foxhole, you know, because you never know who can be there to help you in any given day. I love the expression, the thing I heard one day, be nice to your sponsees. You never know when they're going to be your sponsor. You know? In terms of service and stuff, we're talking about tools, and we'll end up with the tools, but in the beginning, I thought this was, you know, real cynical. I thought this was just a way people get you to do free work. You know, tell me that, and you know, yeah. But I really began to see it differently. You know, it's about being a part of. You know, I feel like these meetings are there for me. Well, you know, there is no professional staff here. You know, people are here. Somebody did this today. Somebody arranged to get the room. Somebody arranged for the publicity. It wouldn't have been there. Somebody was there when I came in. You know, when I came in, I needed that. I needed, you know, and somebody that, I mean, I go back before internet, there was somebody who had a phone answering machine in their house that gave the meeting list. And if that person wasn't there, I wouldn't, you know, be here, you know. And it's important that we keep it going, you know. And one of the great things you see about program is when they tell you stuff, it becomes almost cart before the horse kind of thing. You don't really get what the benefit is until you've done it a while. Like with service, I didn't see the benefit until I looked backwards at it and realized this was about getting me out of myself. This was about doing things for others without thinking about compensation, you know. And I remember years ago that movie Pay It Forward came out. And when it came, I said, we've been doing that for years. This is not, you know. When I first got sober, I was 300 pounds. I was riding a moped, okay? Get a visual of that, okay? I called it cruelty to motor vehicles, right? And the moped died after I don't know how long. And people gave me rides to meetings every day of the week until I finally got a car. And I remember saying, well, I wish I could pay you back. I don't know what I can do. And the guy said, you don't pay me back. You later give people rides. And that's what I do. And I do give people rides from meetings now. And they give it, and they give it, and they give it. And that's, you know, how this thing works. It's meant to be, you know, passed on, you know. And I love in the big book, you know, it talks about going to meetings and doing service and things like that. One of the first stories is Dr. Bob's nightmare, you know, Dr. Bob's story. Near the end of it, you know, he talks about why he still goes to meetings and stuff. Says, I spend a great, this is on page 180, 181. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it to me. And four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. You know, and it doesn't necessarily mean sponsoring, but it's part of that whole service structure. Again, no, you know, nobody's there to do it. I remember I was doing this Sunday meeting quite a while ago, and the same people, I was one of them, the same group kept raising their hands for, you know, for service. And you know, we would trade off, and then finally we were like, you know, and it wasn't like these were, people were just coming and going. It was the same people who weren't doing it. And finally we got together and we said, no, we're done. We're gonna not raise our hands no matter what. And you know what? Nobody raised their hands. And we finally said, okay, at the end of next week, this is our last meeting. And we closed, you know. And there were other people who were coming like, you know, every other week because they couldn't be bothered coming every week. And I said to somebody afterwards, I said, you know, there's part of me wanted to be a fly on the wall when that person who came only every other week showed up that next Sunday and pulled down the locked door. You know, it was almost like part of me wanted to, you know, be like, you know, the angel in It's a Wonderful Life. Well, you weren't there to do service. And so that person didn't do service. And now the meeting is closed. Well, that could happen. You know, that could happen at any time if we're not willing to do that. And it's so sad because I go to my meeting in my other program, or I don't go to it that much anymore, but the Saturday meeting I used to go to. And once every, I forget how many, 6 months, I guess it was, they'd say, okay, this is the week where we come up with new service positions after the meeting. And after the meeting was over and closed, there would be a line of people lined up to take positions. Here, it's like pulling teeth, you know? And you know, part of it is I think people don't want to feel locked down to be there every week and the commitment to being at a meeting. And the reality is most service positions can be co-positions, or it isn't that hard to get somebody to cover for you when you can't be there, you know. I make coffee at kitchen sink. Well, guess what? I'm not here today, but the other John is covering for me. So, you know, it's just what we do. Anyway, let's get to the fourth step, moving out of neutral. You know, I think there's sort of a big gap between the third and fourth step because this is where the work actually starts. There's also a huge fear of the fourth step, you know. I'm a big believer in the columns, as in, you know, on page 65 in the big book. The idea of writing things out and doing them that way. I know other people, I've done the one with the 180 questions and all that. My trouble with that one is you. I always said you use the same part of your brain to do that kind of an inventory that you do to study for the SATs. You know, and if you remember the day after the SATs, it was gone. You know, whereas having this kind of a thing, it lays stuff out and then you're using it later on. You know, the other thing I tell sponsees is I believe in the Nike plan of the fourth step, which is just do it. Just do it. You know, I tell sponsees, you know, it says make a fearless and thorough, inventory, and it doesn't say write a Russian novel. You know, don't write something this big. And it's about, you know, getting out that stuff, not everything that ever annoyed you in the world or your life history. And the other thing I say is, are you sort of committed to this program? They go, yes. It's they realize you're going to do more than one. Just get out as much as you can, as you know, and don't delay it. You know, these people from the early days of AA, they were going through these steps like, and then there's still groups that do it that way. They, you know, will go through in a weekend and go through the steps. The other thing I tell sponsees is, you know, there's 12 steps. There's no such thing as the fourth, fifth step. You know, just like there's no eighth, ninth step. You know, there's a fourth step and there's a fifth step. And I always say the fourth step is for you to get out on paper the stuff you need to look at. And you cannot do this with any thought of who you're going to give it to later, or else you will censor yourself. I can tell you, and this goes back to talking about professionals, I gave one of them to my therapist. And it was immensely valuable, because as I'm reading the stuff about what's going on, he would say, you know, from the past, he'd say, now you see how you still sort of do that now? And he would point out things that I had never seen. So it was like a fifth step on steroids, you know? But the idea of just needs to get it out, you know? And especially the thing about those columns is to look at the end part where it talks about, I start to, you know, a lot of people do the, what's my part in it? You know, what's my part in it? I tell sponsees, if you're technically capable, put it on an Excel spreadsheet. Because then at the end, you can sort by that last column. And you can see ego, you know, all the things, fear. And realize what some of it is.
John, you're recording, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I need to look at my part in it. I need to lose the rationalization. I used to be the master of justification and rationalization, you know. And one of my favorite stories in the Big Book is called Freedom from Bondage. And in there, she says that rationalization is giving a socially acceptable reason for socially unacceptable behavior. And socially unacceptable behavior is a form of insanity. And Dr. Paul, in that On Acceptance, says, I judged myself by my intentions while my world judged me by my actions. You know, and again, I'm the hero of my motion picture in my head. But, you know, in reality, that's not the way other people do. Now, there's another one that this is like one of those, everybody's got a different opinion on this, about putting yourself on a fourth step. AA purists will tell you, no, you don't do that. That's not what it says. I got to tell you, I found in this program, we harmed ourselves as much as anybody else. And the idea of putting ourselves on it, I don't think is an unreasonable thing. Obviously, not at the expense of all the other people that need me on it. But to say, you know, I really did do a lot of damage to myself. I really, you know, I diminished my life, you know, in a lot of ways. And was self-destructive in ways other than just the food. So I do put it on, but everybody's different on that. You know, and then, you know, dealing with what to do, resentments and things like that. Carl, my old sponsor, was a big believer in, you know, when you're starting to do that, he said, just think of the people who are, you know, you've had resentments and stuff like that, and just start write names. Because if you start going like this, you're not going to think. Just start thinking of names first and get as many as you can down. And when you can't think of any others, then start on that. And I guarantee you about halfway through one of those, you go, oh, there's another one. And just keep writing those down to get them out. Because, you know, again, like it says in the Big Book, resentments is our number one, you know, offender. And it's the thing that'll probably make us go out as much as anything, you know. Because, you know, we just have so many resentments. And fears, you know. In the list of fears, I mean, the longer I'm around, the more I get that fear is at the bottom of almost everything. In one way or another, if I keep scraping away, there may be a few, you know, resentments that are justified or not justified, but they're, you know, they're things that have nothing to do. But if I keep scraping down, you know, because I come into program and, you know, I'm a guy. So we guys like anger. You know, that's a macho one, right? You know, I always joke, I say newly sober guys have two emotions, angry and about to get angry, you know. But the longer I'm around and the more I scrape away, first of all, I learned a long time ago, anger is a secondary emotion. It's always on top of something else, fear, hurt, you know, things like that. Now, a lot of times, there's actually a layer above that. A lot of women get depression instead of anger, because they're society. See, society says it's okay for guys to be angry, not fearful, and it says it's okay for women to be depressed but not angry. But if you keep, you know, at the bottom of most of this ends up being some kind of fear or another, hurt, and we'll talk more about that in a second. And we need to look at all that stuff, and again to change how we see fear, and again, that whole idea of if we, you know, fear is lack of faith, and realizing that things will be different. Sex inventory, there's a lot to be said about that. I don't have a lot of time. I'm a big believer in a lot of this. I do a whole thing on retreats on a Saturday night, just talking all about body image and sexuality and self-esteem and all that. But anything that did harm is more than, and obviously the thing about, not making amends if it's going to hurt somebody, but to get it out for yourself. Again, on the fifth step, by the way, I hope everybody keeps sending those Ask It Baskets around just in case. Is again doing it with somebody else. You can do it with a clergyman if you choose. If any sponsor says you have to do it with them, that's not right. That's not true. And if you're a sponsor, don't take it personally. I've had sponsees who didn't want to do it with me. I'm like, I don't have any great thing in it. It's an honor if somebody asked me to do it, but I don't in any way encourage them. I encourage them to get the damn thing done, but I don't tell them what they have to do it with. And I also, I can tell you for me, the first time I did a fifth step, I walked out of there walking on air, okay? Because I had not looked a person in the eye probably for 10 years before I did that, because I just thought I was the worst piece of garbage in the world. I thought, oh my God, And if I'm doing it with my sponsor from AA, and as I'm telling him these things that I think are just the most horrible, worst things in the world, he'd be like, oh, you think that's bad? Let me tell you what I did. And every while I'm getting annoyed, and I'm like, hey, this isn't can you top this here, okay? But I also understood he's trying to make me get that everybody's got stuff in there and that we can get it out. And when I finished that, I walked out, like I said, walking on air, because I all of a sudden was relieved of all of those things, and I could move forward, starting afresh. And again, that's one of those ways that the program does things that you don't understand until you've done them. And until you've done your first fifth step, you don't get how important it is. You don't get how great it's going to be. You know, a lot of these things in program, they're front-loaded with pain. You don't understand until you're done with them that it's going to be good for you, but you have to just trust the process. Like I said before, even if you don't have faith in a higher power, have faith in the process, that this will help and make you better, and it certainly was with me. The other thing is I'll hear people say, I did my fourth step and then I burned it. And I said, I hope you had a copy. remember, you're going to do amends here. What the hell are you going to start the list all over again? So I like to just mention that, And then we move on to step six. Oh, by the way, here's another thing I'll just mention. And this isn't, no, it's not really an outside thing because he's in program and it's no thing. Lori from Canada has a wonderful website which has a great fourth step physical. You can actually download fourth step work that I think is great. And when I was coming up with stuff, I go, I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. He's done a wonderful job with this. So if anybody's interested, I'm going to give you the website and you can write it out. It's OA Big Book, all one word, .info. And like I said, if you're looking for a good structured way to work on a fourth step, that's the thing to do. The basket's there if you need it. So going on to the sixth step, we're entirely ready to have these defects of character removed. Of course, the gotcha word there, entirely. I'm ready to get rid of some of these things, but I'm not sure. But, the thing is that the sixth and seventh step, I just did a whole talk on this on the Vision for You thing a couple of months ago. When I was first in for, I don't know how many years in program, I just wanted to blow through six and seven. Let's get on to the amends. But I really began to understand how important these were. And again, why I think they're crucial for recovery is that my disease will get back in at me through my character defects. And if I don't work on these, I'm going to probably end up going out again, because that's, I'm giving it a foothold. I'm giving it, you know, a way to get there, you know. I also, you know, in talking about the phrase character defects, just talking about this at the break, I don't like the phrase character defects. I understand. Let me just say a thing about the history of this. You know, OA came from AA. AA was started from a group called the Oxford Group, which was, you know, Christian. And it was Christian, and it was based on a lot of Christian stuff. And it used essentially things we have here in the steps, but it used, we had less of them and all that. But, you know, you deal with an organized religion where a lot of times the concept of sin is around, you know. Sin and good and evil, you know. In Judaism, they have something called the Yetzer Hara, you know, and I can't remember the other one is. But the idea of good and evil kind of things. And so you have that kind of idea. And luckily, that sin and good and evil got sort of, you know, brought down to a character defect, which is better. But I still have trouble with it because, you know, just the word defect sort of denotes there's, you know, defectiveness. There's a problem. I think these, for me, at least having these things were developed for me at a very early age. And I think of them as defense mechanisms. These were defense mechanisms that helped me because I grew up in a crazy household. And they were, you know, we're not idiots. We don't come up with these just out of nowhere. They did something for us, right? They did something that helped us. And so, you know, they are character defects. But as we go on, I think of them also as character liabilities. You know, in accounting, there's liabilities and there's assets. They're working against us. And so if I can change the way I look at it, it's important. You know, to move away from that sort of moral and religious thinking into the idea that these are things that may have helped us at one point but are now not helping us anymore, you know. And, you know, in terms of the phrase defense mechanisms, well, they're no longer defense. They've gone over to the offense and they're working against me. And, you know, and the other thing about the concept of defects is, you know, instead of thinking of it as the devil and the angel on my shoulders, I got to remember that this sort of flies into the face of the concept that we have a disease. You know, if we have a disease, good and evil, defects, you know, right and wrong, it's just not very congruent. And I need to realize that part of my disease includes bad character traits and things like that that may then come underneath from some kind of spiritual malady, but to not think of it in that same way and to just realize these are things that need to be changed, because at least then it pulls up that upper layer of guilt of I'm a bad person, you know? I'm not. I, you know, there's this great movie I loved years ago called Breaking Morant, and it was about a war crime. And I won't go through the whole thing, but these people were on trial for a war crime in the middle of this horrendous war. And the person said something to the effect of war crimes are not committed by abnormal people. They're done by normal people in abnormal situations. And if I think about the character defects and how I got them because I was a normal person in an abnormal situation that developed abnormal ways of doing things just to cope. Well, now they're not working and they're working against me. So I need to look at how they, you know, they're different, you know. Let me see. So, the key is being entirely ready. If we believe all these things they tell us, that we got to be willing to go to any lengths, not just in how we put down the food, but to do the rest of these things, we have to be willing to, as they say in the big book, you know, clear it out root and branch. And for me, you know, it's, you know, I want that. And so I can't play Russian roulette with my recovery. I have to be willing to do all these things, because that's what they told me. They told me I have to do this to get better. Now, it's easier said than done. Let's face it. I remember when I was first getting sober, I had one of those funny cable boxes, you know, the cable box that gets everything and it's free. And I remember saying to my sponsor, does that mean I got to give this thing up? And he just looks at me and goes, what do you think? You know, and it's like, I didn't want to, because I liked that. And I didn't want to have to pay for cable. Well, guess what? You know, that's, you know, how much did I spend on food that month before that when I had my free cable, right? And then I'm eating $400 worth of food. So, you know, you know, I don't want to look at that. But that's another level of surrender, right? It's another level of and it also requires another level of faith. All these steps in one way or another require faith, not necessarily in a higher power, but that what these people who came before you told you is true. And even though, again, sort of front-loaded with pain, you don't understand why, you will at some point in the future. Just like you may not have understood in the beginning why giving up the food was important, now you do. And maybe you didn't understand why doing this fourth step was important, but now you do because you've done the fifth step. And again, you see how these slide one to the next effortlessly, because if you've somehow gotten some faith in the process, you can do the fourth, and then you can do the fifth, and then you can say, well, I do want to be ready to get rid of all of these. I'll talk about some character defects that are mine, because that's all I can, you know, I mean, there's other things, but, you know, I always talk about my two major families of character defects for me are immaturity and narcissism, okay? And in another way, it's narcissism, just a fancy word for self-centeredness, as it says in the big book. But immaturity is a big one for me. You know, like I was saying earlier, the thing that my whole sponsee said about, we want to eat what we want and whenever we want and not have any of the effects. Well, that's part of the immaturity. Or, you know, the immaturity of, I don't have to work for anything. You know, I want what I want. I want what Terrell's got, but I don't want to go to the meetings he does. I don't want to be doing the writing, you know. I mean, one of Terrell's sponsees, Jack, you know, every week at the end of Kitchen Sink, they're sitting down and they're reading. And guess what? Jack's got 34 years, you know. It's so funny. Once a year, Jack and Terrell happen to take their candles the same week, and Jack is always 3 years behind. So, and I love to tell people. I'll tell people around the country. I was just at a meeting last week where a guy took a candle for 34 years, and he wasn't the oldest one. He wasn't the one with the most time. But the fact is that I want what Jack has. I do what Jack does, and Jack at 34 years is still doing things like that. And that's the maturity to say, okay, you know, I want that. I remember saying to a sponsee once. Or where did I hear it? Oh, it was the guy gave this wonderful TED talk on procrastination, and he said, and the guy's a procrastinator, how he got out of it. He says, and then I got told I had to do this TED talk, and I'm like, oh my God, I gotta have to write stuff up. I'm gonna have to get it ready. And he says, you know, it was always my great desire to have done a TED talk. You know, it was always my great desire to have been abstinent, not to do the work to get there, and that's part of the immaturity of me, you know. And part of that little, you know, five-year-old. I was saying at lunch that one of the reasons I went to that other program that had the strict food plan for a while was that I was just too immature to deal with OA. You know? You know, because I'd be sitting there going, well, if she gets to eat cake, I want to eat cake. And if that guy gets to eat that, I want to eat that. Well, that person can eat that and stop. I can't. You know, I have sponsees who can eat stuff I can't eat, and vice versa. That's that little immature part. So I had to go over there for a while until I could come back and really get a handle on it, you know? And I talk about some of these other programs that have these strict kind of things versus OA. I say, well, think of them as they're like high school and we're college. You know, think of it. If you didn't go to school in high school, somebody got a phone call, right? You know, where is so-and-so? You get to college, they're like, how much are you paying a credit? You don't want to come? You're an idiot. You know, go ahead. Stay out all the time. Just keep sending us the money. Well, it's the same here. You can do whatever you want, but, you know, come on. At some point, the mature part of you has to say, hey, you know. And it's like with Ray, who says, I eat whatever I want as long as I'm willing to pay the price. That's a mature person. But my little immature person, that is essentially the core of my disease, that where my disease will get back in, doesn't want to think that way. Oh, you can't have that. I can have any food I want today. If I want to leave here and go, I can. Am I willing to pay the price? No, because I know some of those foods I'm never going to be able to stop. And you know, that's part of grasping powerlessness. You know, when I talk, you saw some of the pictures, Dan and Jim, and there was another guy, Murray. I know Andy knows Murray. God bless him. He died as well from this disease. And the thing that scares me sometimes is not all three of those guys, it wasn't like they had never been abstinent, had never been gotten it. They had it. They had it and they gave it away. And they're dead. And I know if I'd have said to Murray the day he picked up that first bite, you know, if you pick up that first bite, you're going to go out. And then you'll try and come back, and you won't be able to come, you'll have trouble, and you'll go out. Then you'll leave for a little while, you'll try to come back, and then eventually you'll die. That first bite's going to be a lot different in thought than what he did. And that's why, you know, for me today, I've got to keep remembering, you know, that. And when my disease wants to whine at me and tell me, oh, I can't have that, and go, no, I can have it. I just could end up like Murray. I don't want to end up like Murray, you know. Or end up, you know, I got a friend in Las Vegas that just breaks my heart. He's 10 years younger than me. He's using a scooter. He's using a walker. There's another guy from my neck of the woods who has, he ran the birthday party in 2003. I just heard the other day, you know, they took a meeting to him. He's 500 pounds. He's bedridden. He can't get out of his house. I know that, you know, the one thing about this, about getting this is I realize that can happen to me, you know, and I can't do that. In terms of narcissism, ego, self-centeredness, whatever you want to call it, I was raised with narcissistic parents. And so as a result, you tend to get that in one way or another. There's a couple of really great books about that I won't talk about here, but I've read, you know, and you begin to realize, you know, I was, you know, like it talks about relieving me of the bondage self or the whirlpool of self. Everything in some way or another had to do with me, you know. I took so many things personally that I had no need to, you know, that they didn't have anything to do with me, you know. My old therapist said, my current therapist, he said, never attribute to maliciousness what can be better attributed to cluelessness. You know, I'd get mad because some guy cut me off on the highway. No, he's just paying no attention. He's on his phone. He's God knows what, you know. But I used to take all that stuff personally. They're doing it to me. Don't they know who I am? You know, it's just that, you know, there's the ego. And then paranoia, you know. You can't be paranoid if you don't have an ego. If you can't, you think so, oh, look what people are doing to me, you know. You know, but I was raised with this. You know, over in Al-Anon, they had this thing called a checklist for emotional... it was the ACA checklist. And one of the questions is, do you think people in society in general are out to get you? And I remember, I said, I think my mother actually sat me in a chair and said, people in society in general are out to get us. You know? And it's just, you know, it's just totally not true, you know? I love, somebody said one time, he said, the thing that would bother me most about what people thought about me is just how little they actually think about me, you know? And it's true, you know? Again, that's that's self, you know? But that's the problem. I wanted everything my way all the time, and I would be mad, frustrated, and whatever when it didn't happen that way. And it says in the book, you know, we are perfect examples of self-will run riot. I want everything my way, and that's not gonna work, you know. I remember there's another piece of Al-Anon literature that says it's called the checklist. I love this, a checklist for our emotional maturity. You know, anybody wants to ask me about it later. But one of the ones I love that really jumped out at me is it said, a mature person accepts reasonable delay without impatience, realizing that some adjustment for the convenience of others is necessary. You know, wow, what a concept, right? If I want green lights, I got to accept that once in a while other people have a right to a green light that is going in a different direction, and I didn't want it. In self-righteous anger, that's, again, number one offender for me. Number one offender, especially when I know I'm right, because that allows me to just let the stops off and go on an emotional binge. And I love that phrase, emotional binge, because I have done that, you know, more than one time, you know, totally an abstinent, totally sobriety, but bam, when I'm right, that allows me even more, ha-ha. Well, there was a guy when I was newly sober named Nicky, and he used to say, when it comes to some kind of thing where there's a conflict, whether you're right or whether you're wrong, one of two things is going to be true. Either you're going to be wrong and you have no right to be angry, or you're right and you have no need to be angry. And I got thinking, you know, that's really, you know, and the longer I'm around, the more I get it. You know, at the end of the day, all of this anger, I'm the one with the stomach acid, right? Oh, I'm sitting around, that bastard did that. Blah, blah, blah. He's clueless. I'm the one walking around with the churning stuff. And so that's why a lot of this program, I got to realize it's about, in some ways, I don't do these things necessarily for these Gandhi-like selfless reasons. I do them because they're helping me. You know, again, I'm the one with the stomach acid that's not churning anymore. And I got to remember that. How important is it, you know? And to remember that. You know, that other great phrase, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy, you know? And I had a sponsee who was a lawyer, and I said to him once, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And he says, well, what if the only way I can be happy is to be right? To which I said, oh, you are a lawyer, aren't you? You know, but in my family, and you know, I had to be right old, you know, because you know, if you admitted, you know, any kind of wrong, you were a target in my family, and I realized that no, I needed to do that. I don't anymore, you know. Oh, a great line I heard somebody say once: I'm not allowed to have arguments with people who aren't currently in the room. And I think how often my brain has gone off on that kind of stuff, and I just don't do that. But again, you know, the worst trait of all of these kind of things with me and my ego is terminal uniqueness. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm different. Again, I got raised at being the fat kid who was the brainiac, who moved a lot, and to me, I was unique. And it took me years in program to not realize that there weren't just two sets in the world, John and everybody else. But I get today, thanks to program, that's not true, you know. I'm not terminally unique. And the thing about that is when you're no longer terminally unique, you become teachable, you know. Whereas before, I wasn't really teachable, you know. You know, again, great brain. You told me if I went to the kitchen, let's say the griddle had been on and it's off, oh, don't touch that, it's hot. I would have to go over and go, ow, you're right, it is hot, you know. You know, because I, for whatever reason, I would need to check that myself. I couldn't trust you. I remember somebody saying once that intelligent people learn from their mistakes, but wise people learn from other people's mistakes. You know, and I think now about somebody like Jim or Dan or Murray, and I think, you know, there but for the grace of God, if that can happen to them, it can happen to me, you know. Murray was a genius. There's things on the moon, I swear to God. He was literally a rocket scientist. There are things on the moon that Murray put on the moon. And if that can happen to him with his intelligence, it can happen to me. And that's why, you know, I have to keep working on this stuff. Another one of my things that doesn't fall into those categories is that control issue thing, you know. I have to work on that and stop and to realize things don't always have to go my way, and sometimes trying somebody else's way, and then wow, what do you know? That was actually a better way to do things, you know. I came in various programs, be on a board of the intergroup and have to work with other people, and God, there's always hecklers here. See, if I was paranoid, I'd say he's laughing at me. Yeah. but to then start to work with people and be willing to try other things. Again, open-mindedness, again, with other people's ideas. And then, you know, because again, that's a lot of times how I'll learn is to try something different. Not, well, let's do it my way. My way is going to be the right way. You know, well, sometimes my way is the right way, but not all the time. Another thing that was a thing my disease used against me was cynicism and intellectualization, okay? I'm so smart, I'm going to be the smartest 600-pound guy in the room, you know? And when it comes to cynicism, I'll tell you, I joke, I said, I have the trifecta of cynicism. I am an alcoholic comedian from New York, okay? You put those together, and I'm going to roll my eyes at an awful lot of stuff that's said in this program, you know? But I got to realize today what cynicism really is. Somewhere underneath cynicism is something that is hitting a little close to home. And maybe it's something I don't understand or something that threatens me. So if I can be sarcastic and make a joke about it, I don't have to really deal with it, you know? And today I can sort of strip down and realize that, you know, again, underneath that somewhere is some kind of fear. I mean, I'll give you the perfect example. The first time I heard, again, imagine cynical, I hear the phrase positive affirmations, you know, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to go stand in front of a mirror and say, oh, you're a good person, gosh darn it, and people like you, right? But how many times had I taken all the negative affirmations I had? And I just bought them hook, line, and sinker, right? I'm a piece of garbage. I do this, I do that. When I was back home, right before my mother passed away, she had a dish in her hand. She turned around and caught her elbow on the refrigerator door and dropped the dish. And she went, you stupid bastard. And I go, oh, that's where I got that, you know. No, she was human. She didn't want to do that. She was human. But to her, it was about being a stupid bastard. And how many of those things had I inculcated in my head over the years? And said no. So how am I going to get rid of them other than to find a way to reverse that? But maybe some positive affirmations. Or at least catch myself when I'm doing the negative ones and say, cut it out. Cut it out. You're a human being, you know. Harlan says, one of my favorite guys says, No matter how much we learn about this program, we memorize these 164 pages into 12 and 12, we don't rise above the level of human being. And on any given day, no matter how much we know, no matter how much we're trying to make this program work, we're going to fall on our faces. We're going to have an emotional binge. We're going to do something we have to go make amends for. And it's not good, but it's not the end of the world, and we don't need to beat ourselves up. We need to try and change it, but we don't have to, you know, have that stick and whack ourselves. And I did that for so long. So, you know, I do try occasionally to remember when I do something good and just at least say, hey, look at that. You know, you're not the piece of garbage you used to tell yourself. I love that grandiosity has us at the top or at the bottom, right? We can never just be in the middle. I love that phrase, we're the piece of shit the world revolves around. you know? And, you know, it's just so true, you know? But again, that's how my disease can get in. You know, it'll find something and I'll be sarcastic about it instead of thinking about maybe this is something I have to watch out for. Perfectionism, that's another big part. You know, I mentioned before, if I got a food plan and I ate a pea I shouldn't have, well, what the hell, right? And there's a lady named Nanette in our area who always says perfectionism is the conjoined twin of compulsive eating. You know, that we have to be so careful about not to make that. Not to say you can't go right off the other side, but to be careful of that. If I can't do it perfectly, I don't want to do it at all. You know, and that has been, it was always a problem with me. I tried to get into, learn a few things in the last few years that involve physical stuff, like playing the piano, you know. And the trouble is, I'm just another person when it comes to physical stuff. I have a really good brain, so if I went to learn things that involved intellect, bam, I'm at the, you know, I all the way through school, I didn't have to study as hard as everybody. Well, guess what? When it comes to this, I had to just be willing to be the same as anybody else, and I couldn't stand that. You know, I wanted to be perfect. But again, that's part of an immature attitude, right? There is no such thing as perfect. Life isn't, you see, part of my problem is that I at a certain age, I ended up sort of raising myself. My father was never home. And I raised myself from like about age, what was it, 13, from 13 on. So the trouble is for a parent, I had a 13-year-old parent. Well, you know, society doesn't let 13-year-olds be parents. Not because maybe they could figure out how to do some of these things, but they're not emotionally mature enough to be parents. But I was. I was being my own parent. And what I learned at 13 years old is there were two states of being. There was perfect and there was shit. And if I wasn't perfect, I was shit. You know, and that's immature. It's black-white thinking. You know, the world isn't made up of black and white. It's, you know, it's not even made up of gray. It's made up of thousands of colors. And we can't just, you know, do it that way. We need, and that's part of the idea of some of the maturity, you know. And part of that was I look, and again, you scrape and you hit fear. The fear is I'm not as good as you. So what have I got to do? I got to be perfect if I want to be able to compare myself to you. You know, instead of saying, you know what, I'm like you. I'm better in some things than you. I'm worse than you in some things. And that's just life, you know. A lady named Chris P. down in Orange County says, the shortest distance to insanity is through comparison. You know, if I think about it, when I compare myself, I am also setting up my how I feel about myself. Because I very rarely compare myself to people who are better, that are less than me. Oh, look at me. I'm always looking, oh, look at that person does that better than me. Oh, that person is more attractive than me or whatever. And I realize that's just reinforcing the view of myself. And I need to change that and realize I'm going to be better in some things and worse in others. And that's just the way it is, you know. You know, and again, sometimes it's about me having an ego. You know, I'm going to pump on my ego because I'm going to tell you this and it sounds really bad, but remember, I had no sobriety. I walked in and I remember saying to somebody in my first, I don't know how long in program, I said, you know, I've read a lot, I know a lot about psychology and I have a superiority complex. And I know that for most people with superiority complex, it's masking an inferiority complex. But in my case, I'm just superior. Now, of course, a little bit of time in program, what did that superiority complex go on top of? An inferiority complex, because I'm not good enough and I got to pump my ego up somehow. And I got to make sure you know how smart I am, or I got to make sure you know about this thing I've done or that. Because I don't feel good enough without having some way to pump myself up. And that's that fear that I'm not enough. And that's a big part of what it's about. You know, in years in program, I get I am, you know. But it's still hard because, you know, again, I got to remember I'm a human being. And that all of these things that are in this big book, in the 12 and 12, They're ideals toward which we strive, but chances are we're never going to hit, you know? Because when I read, you know, I'll give you an example. This is one that used to always get me. In the big book on the 10th and 11th steps, it goes into stuff about constructively reviewing our day. And it says here, were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Were we kind and loving toward all? Were we thinking of our others most of the time? And I'd be like, no, on a lot of that stuff. And it would make me feel, well, look at this. I got all this time in the program, and I'm still selfish and dishonest and afraid and not kind and loving toward all. And I realized, well, you know, who is all the time? I think, well, I'm much better than I used to be, but I'm not there. But there was a part of me that wanted to, you know, couldn't accept that, okay, I wasn't going to be perfect, you know? And that was part of it, you know. The other thing that, I'm going to read this, you know, most of you guys know page 417 of the big book, which talks about acceptance, and I love that, and is that my old credit card? actually, let me read the acceptance thing, because I always like that, and if you haven't heard in a while, it's important, you know. By the way, this chapter, Acceptance is the Answer, was the answer. One of the best things about living life in general, from this, at least from this paragraph forward. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes. You know? And you know, the bottom line, you know, talking about accepting what's there, that, you know, the world's going to be what the world's going to be no matter whether I accept it or not. I'm just the one who's going to either have churned up stomach acid or a lot more serenity, you know. But the next line, the next paragraph is the one that really affected me because it was a lot about me. Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. He forgot to mention that I was the chief critic. I was always able to see the flaw in every person, in every situation. I was always glad to point it out because I know you wanted perfection just as I did. AA and acceptance have taught me that there's a bit of good in the worst of us, a bit of bad in the best of us, that we are all children of God, and we all have a right to be here. When I'm complaining about me or about you, I am complaining about God's handiwork. I'm saying I know better than God. And you know, I read that for I don't know how long, and I read it to people for how long, and I always read that as in help of my judgmentalism, because like I said, I had trouble accepting the fact that I wasn't perfect, so I judged myself very harshly, and I in turn judged other people. I expected them to not be human, you know, and they were human, and as a result, as I started to accept myself more as human, I got a lot more less judgmental. But the other thing, and I'm going to stop right after this. We'll take a break, right? And I think we should be, be a good time. I read this for so long, and I read the thing. It says, when I complain about me or you, I'm complaining about God's handiwork. But in my head, what I heard was, when I'm complaining about you, I'm complaining about God's handiwork. But it doesn't say that. It says, when I'm complaining about you or me, that I got to accept I'm exactly right where I'm supposed to be. I may not like it. I may want to be a better person. You know, every day I do. You know, I joke, I said, my poor first wife, she got John 1.0, you know. And I was in a long-term relationship between the two marriages, and she got John 2.0, and my current wife got John 3.0, you know. And John 4.0 is in beta, you know, day in, day out. But that's where I am. And that if I want to, you know, all I can do is try to be a better person, you know. And that's, you know, the key to getting better and to realize I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, but I can still try a little better. So we'll take a quick break and then we'll come back for more for the end.
And don't forget, if you need a sponsor or a